many more. Again, that's the Aurora Colony Vineyards Jazz Festival, August 9th, from 2 to 9 p.m. More information about directions and ticket prices can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Ooh, what a little moonlight can do. This song could go on without any end, till you realize that your car is not your friend. We're all car addicts, let's just say no, then those cars will have to go.
Help support KBOO Community Radio by donating your used car, truck, motorcycle, boat, or any other vehicle. We'll transform that old machine into resources for unserved and underserved communities, free training, recording equipment, and great programming for the Portland metro area, Cascadia, and the world. For more information, call 1-877-526-6123. That's 877-KBOO-123. Or go to kboo.fm/vehicle.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Matt Dishman Community Center annual block party on Saturday, August 8th from noon to 4 p.m. This family-friendly event will include barbecue grub, live music and a DJ, activities for kids, family swim in the pool, local vendors, and more. Again, that's the Matt Dishman Community Center annual block party on Saturday, August 8th from noon to 4 p.m. at Matt Dishman Community Center, 77 Northeast Knott Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And this is KBOO Portland. It's 9:01 a.m. Coming up on Political Perspectives, host Doug McVeigh speaks with Inga Freiklund. I'm guessing on that pronunciation, Freiklund, board member of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, or LEAP. Speaking about LEAP, the development of the war on drugs and the movement for the legalization. At 10, Air Cascadia is off today. We'll hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11, Sarika Mehta hosts Intersections Radio, aiming to connect communities through unique and unexpected stories. At 11:30 on the Radio Zine, we speak with members of the Chilean reggae band Aflora Reggae about the state of the educational system in Chile, the impact of the neoliberal economy and the exploitation of natural resources, and the intention of their music to promote unity in the world. Well, that's all coming up on your community radio, and thank you for listening to KBOO, and thanks KBOO members for your generous support. Those of you who have not yet become a member of the KBOO Foundation can remedy that oversight by going to kboo.fm. Just click where it says donate today. And now, as promised, here's KBOO's own Doug McVeigh speaking with a board member of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, or LEAP.
I'm speaking today with Inga Freiklund. She's a former assistant state's attorney from Chicago, Illinois, and these days she serves as a member of the board of directors of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. Inga, first off, could you tell our listeners about LEAP?
Well, LEAP, which stands for Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, is a group of about 150,000 current and former law enforcement personnel and their supporters in 127 countries that are trying to stop the war on drugs. Our mantra is legalize so that you're able to manage, regulate, and control.
Now, how did you get involved? Actually, no. You know, the better question probably is, first, why did you get involved with LEAP?
It's been an evolution. This was back in the 1980s when I was an assistant state's attorney in Chicago. That's what, same thing as district attorney in Oregon. And I prosecuted drug cases, among other things. And I didn't think a whole lot about it, except, hey, drugs are bad. These people who have drugs, we'll lock them up. But the more I saw of it, the more some questions started coming to mind. For example, even though we know that the rates of drug usage for across racial groups is pretty much the same, it was predominantly black defendants that I saw in court. More, a handful of Hispanics, very few whites. So certainly there's some racial bias in how our drug laws, which are supposedly race neutral, are actually working out. The other thing I noticed was the number of repeat customers. Oh, somebody gets arrested for drugs this week. He was also in a week ago, a month ago. You look at a rap sheet, all these drug arrests and convictions, you know this person is never going to get a job in the legitimate economy. So all we were doing was cycling them back into the drug economy. And that was having the knock-on effects of, you know, here are all these men, many of whom had children, dysfunctional or broken up families, kids without fathers. And then that in turn had consequences for how they were going to do in school. So we're raising another generation, kind of behind the eight ball to start with. And then I moved on to doing other things besides being a prosecutor. And then the next kind of evolution in my history is since 2004, I've spent a total of 5 years in Afghanistan. Our policies of having opium poppy illegal means that there is a tremendous amount of corruption in Afghanistan. And we have turned the place into a narco state. And there's a great deal of governmental corruption in Afghanistan, mostly due to our policies. And we would go around and try to eradicate drugs, which was part of the local economy. I've also observed what's going on in some other countries, like Mexico. Remember, we read about 48 university students kidnapped and their bodies trashed and burned somewhere. If that were going on in the U.S., we would be thinking, rethinking the drug war real fast. So for all of these things over a period of probably 20 years, when I got back in the States 2 years ago, I joined law enforcement against prohibition and decided to do whatever I could to stop the war on drugs.
And so what exactly do you do with LEAP?
Well, on the board of directors, you know, and we sort of make policy decisions about what we're going to be doing and what we support. I do a lot of writing, various op-ed articles. I've had a couple in the Huffington Post just recently. I do speaking tours. And last fall, when Measure 91 was on the ballot in Oregon, I did a lot of traveling around Oregon and speaking about drugs. So it's a combination of things. And we're gearing up for 2016 when the several states are going to have ballot initiatives. And LEAP will do what it can to support, both with op-eds, position papers, and speakers.
Now, you mentioned that you've worked in Afghanistan. You've been a rule of law and elections consultant, forgive me. Done a lot of work on institutional development there. I saw from your resume, at one point, you even worked as an advisory to the UN drug program in Afghanistan. I want to get on to domestic policy, but could you speak a little more about the impact of U.S. drug policy on other nations?
Well, Afghanistan was the one I've been closest to. We insist on making it illegal, and the UN estimates that the ultimate street value of what comes out of Afghanistan is about $68 billion. Not very much of that stays in Afghanistan. It's mostly profits elsewhere. But when there is that much money at stake on the demand side, somebody is going to supply it. And you can't wish away supply and demand. That's just how it works. One of the things I noticed when I was working with the Marine Corps in southwestern Afghanistan, the position of an Afghan district chief of police out in the middle of absolute nowhere, working out of some mud brick building, he was buying the position for $150,000 a year. And you know that he was expecting to recoup his investment. And a lot of the violence, people we referred to as insurgents in southern Afghanistan, actually had no huge interest in the U.S. They didn't want to attack us. All they were trying to do was protect the drug networks. So we ended up fighting and getting our soldiers and Marines killed in, you know, things which really weren't affecting our country at all directly. We just happened to trip into the middle of the drug trade. And remember, we went to Afghanistan because of September 11th. Now we got there and got ourselves detoured fighting drugs. I think there's probably even more damage that the U.S. has inflicted in South and in Mexico and Central America. Now, in this country, citizens can vote for whatever policies we want, whether it's Measure 91 or something else. In these countries, because they're so heavily dependent on the U.S., we're essentially holding a big stick over them and requiring them to make drugs illegal. But they're producing something which it's mostly the U.S. wants. And as a result, this, in effect, has empowered the cartels that are active right now in Mexico and Central America, like this guy who just escaped, El Chapo Guzman, so analogous to Al Capone during prohibition of alcohol back in the 1920s. You make something illegal, the natural and inevitable result is going to be crime and corruption. And I think we're damaging democracy in Mexico and Central America because the citizens can't vote to get themselves out from under it. U.S. is too powerful. So it's as though we have succeeded in offloading a lot of the violence of our war on drugs onto these other countries. There's not that much violence and corruption in the U.S. It's mostly in the producer and transit countries. And I have a real ethical question with us inflicting this on other countries.
You're listening to KBOO in Portland, Oregon. My name is Doug McVeigh, and I'm talking today with my guest, Inga Frickland. She's an attorney, formerly an assistant state's attorney, prosecutor from Chicago, Illinois. She's a board member of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. I want to turn to the domestic side, and you were actually working at the state's attorney's office in Chicago during what some would consider the height of the drug war, the Reagan era. Actually, it was the beginning of it. If you look at the arrest stats, it got a lot worse as time has gone on. But it was really quite intense. I was working in reform back then, and really wasn't a time to say the words legalization. It's quite a different time. Could you talk about how the drug war has developed? How have we gotten to where we are today?
Well, it's been a long evolution. The first drugs that were made illegal were opiates and heroin back in 1914 by something called the Harrison Tax Act. And there's very little legislative history as to why this was made federally illegal. And what little legislative history there is very interesting. There were two main themes. One, the fear of, quote, cocaine-crazed Negroes, unquote, in the South who might rape white women. And in California, again, to quote, it was Chinamen might entice white women into using opium. So this was a very both nativist and racial animus behind the legislation. And it was my demographic they were trying to protect, middle-aged white women. Nobody said anything about kids. That's come along much later as a rationalization. So this was aimed mostly at minority communities. Fast forward to 1935 when marijuana was made illegal. And I think there was some concern there that, hey, black musicians, people like that, actually use the stuff. But the war on drugs didn't seriously take off until 1971 under President Nixon. And I think because of his own political problems, he thought maybe there was mileage in having a war on drugs. He's the one responsible for this federal schedule of drugs. He appointed a commission chaired by Governor Schaefer of Pennsylvania back in 71. And their mandate was to look at the evidence on different drugs and make some recommendations about scheduling. Schaefer's Commission came back saying marijuana doesn't belong here at all. It's no more addictive than caffeine. And Nixon's response to that was to say, you people had better get in line. This is going to be made illegal, and it's going to be made Schedule One. And on the Nixon tapes, he's also quoted as saying, it's a black thing, but we can't say that. So here we are 40 years after Watergate, and we're still living with the overhang of President Nixon's, you know, racial bias and lack of attention to scientific evidence. And since that time, we have spent over $1 trillion fighting the war on drugs. And the addiction rate has been roughly constant as far back as 1914. About 1.3% of the population is addicted to something. So all of our war on drugs, extremely damaging, extremely expensive, has had virtually no effect on the availability or use of drugs.
Moving forward to today, there has been a rather strong push lately for sentencing reform. Advocates on the left and the right, really everywhere across the political spectrum, are starting to express concerns about over-incarceration. The president, of course, recently visited the El Reno Federal Correctional Institution in Oklahoma. While he was there, among other things, he had this to say.
So we've got an opportunity to make a difference at a time when overall violent crime rates have been dropping, at the same time as incarcerations last year dropped for the first time in 40 years. My hope is that if we can keep on looking at the evidence, keep on looking at the facts, figure out what works, that we can start making a change, that will save taxpayers money, keep our streets safe, and perhaps most importantly, keep families intact and break this cycle in which young people, particularly young people of color, are so prone to end up in a criminal justice system that makes it harder for them to ever get a job and ever be effective, full citizens of this country.
Now, I want to ask you about what kinds of changes you'd suggest to the president that we should be making in order to achieve the goals that he's listing. But first, I have to ask, what do you think about the fact that he said it?
I think the fact that he visited a federal prison and he's even talking about these issues is a definite step forward. But as I wrote in a Huffington Post op-ed piece a couple days ago, I think he's just nibbling at the margins. He's talking about reforming sentencing, which is important. We have 5% of the world's population and 25% of its prisoners, which is disgusting. But rather than just talk about sentencing, I would say let's examine the underlying crimes. Now, he's still referring to people who got arrested for drugs as offenders. To take an analogy back with prohibition of alcohol, no longer have prohibition on the books. You know, we don't talk about sentencing people for selling alcohol because it's perfectly legal. So rather than nibbling at the margins by making some adjustments in sentencing, just stop having these drug offenses be crimes. Then you don't have to worry about sentencing because nobody gets arrested or sentenced for any of this. So he's moved a tiny baby step in the right direction. But what I think he should do is take on the entire war on drugs. And if he can talk to Iran and Cuba, he ought to be able to address this one too. And say, we made a terrible mistake. And just as we did after prohibition of alcohol, we say, stop. We made a mistake in making it illegal. Let's make it illegal, then we can regulate it and quit using the criminal justice system.
So now, just to be clear, when we're talking about legalize, of course, Oregon just partially legalized marijuana, but you actually mean to legalize drugs.
That's right across the board. And I think part of our problem in talking about this is kind of the language we have available. When you say the word legalize, that almost has acquired a connotation of seal of approval. So if someone says legalize heroin, oh, that sounds really scary. But we're talking about legalize only because it was made illegal. And the fact that something is a problem or a really bad idea, it does not follow logically that it should be made illegal. Like, for example, obesity is a tremendous problem in this country. It kills far more people than drugs, you know, with all the effects of high blood pressure and diabetes. But we have not made sugar or high fructose corn syrup illegal. You know, we don't raid farmers who are growing corn. So the fact that something is a problem does not necessarily mean it ought to be illegal. So what LEAP means by legalize all drugs is just quit using the criminal justice system. Instead, think about legalizing so that you can regulate. I mean, alcohol is a problem. It still is a problem. But we have managed to regulate it, so it's pretty hard for minors to get their hands on the stuff. Back during prohibition of alcohol, hundreds of people died of adulterated alcohol. Now that's essentially a non-issue because everything has to be labeled. You know, I go into one of the microbreweries here in Oregon, and the first thing I check is the ABV on the beer bottle, alcohol by volume, because I know my tolerance. I know what I can safely drink. So legalize. Now, that's almost an easy call for marijuana because I think that's more analogous to our craft beer industries. But legalizing heroin or cocaine means that, you know, instead of criminal sanctions, we use education and we deal with it as a public health matter. A good example of that is Switzerland. Way back in 1994, they decriminalized heroin. Any heroin addict can go to a government clinic and can shoot up with pharmaceutical-grade heroin. What they've found is there hasn't been a death at a government clinic since they started doing this, because people know exactly what they're injecting. Rates of HIV and hepatitis transmission are down. Crime is down. And there are fewer young people even trying heroin, partly because there's nothing glamorous about thumbing your nose at the adults to get something that's served up at a government clinic. And they pretty much shut down the shooting galleries that were sites for social recruitment. And Switzerland is very happy with what they've done. 2001, Portugal decriminalized everything. And their experience is the same. Addictions down, HIV, hepatitis down, overdoses down. So, and these are fairly conservative countries. So when we're talking about legalizing heroin and cocaine, what we're meaning is a model like this, that the substances are available for somebody who's actually addicted and wants help with it. And there isn't the problem of overdose. U.S. gets 3,500 to 4,000 overdose heroin deaths a year. And a lot of that is due to adulterated substances. Nobody knows what the purity is. So because of our policy of keeping heroin illegal, we're essentially killing 3,000 to 4,000 of our own citizens every year. And I think that's a mistake. So yes, legalize everything, which means once it's out from under the shadows, you can regulate and control and manage.
And this, just across the border in Canada, up in Vancouver, they've had an experiment going on for some time. The earlier one was called NAOMI, the North American Opiate Medication Initiative. Eventually that ended and they started Salome, which for the life of me, I can't remember what that stands for. But it, once again, is essentially, it's like substitution treatment, not like we have here with very strictly regulated methadone and very strictly regulated buprenorphine, but a regulated system of heroin maintenance, diacetylmorphine or heroin maintenance. Do you think it really is just as simple as the word scaring people? When they think of legalization, they think of, well, we're about, as we record this, there's about to be another beer fest in the city of Portland. I could have said that practically any weekend in the entirety of summer. In fact, now that I think about it, there are beer fests all the time here in Portland. Do you think it really is as simple as that? Just a lack of understanding of what is really meant, the sort of simplistic definitions?
I do think that's a big part of it. And people are somehow afraid that having something not be prohibited means that people are going to go nuts using it. And the experience from Switzerland and Portugal is that simply does not happen. But there's, I suppose, because we've had, you know, two generations at least of the war on drugs, it's become a very emotional topic for people. For example, just last week I was out in Ontario testifying at a city council meeting. Remember the counties that had more than 55% of people opposed to Measure 91 could their city councils vote to prohibit both dispensaries and recreational outlets. And even after the end of the testimony, they voted to prohibit everything. But it was interesting, the testimony from citizens, all this talk about, you know, the damage that drugs had done to families, people out in a lot of the rural areas getting hooked on opiates, turning to heroin, crime associated with marijuana, all of these things were going on while it was illegal. So illegality clearly did not solve the problem. And I think it's a quote from Einstein, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different result. But I was just struck in Ontario by the amount of emotion associated with this. And somehow they seemed to believe that having a marijuana dispensary in town was going to make it more available to their kids. It's available right this minute. But a dispensary, something that's licensed by the state, or a retail outlet for recreational, is going to be highly regulated. And as in Colorado, where there are sting operations to see if anybody's selling to children, you've got a much better grip on what's going on if something's is legal. But there's so much fear and emotion attached to this. I think it's going to take a little while to get beyond that. But the more experience we have, such as Washington State and Colorado, which have shown no increase in teen use, no increase in traffic accidents, at some point reality is going to set in and people will be able to think a little more logically about cause and effect and the analogies with prohibition of alcohol. Prohibiting something that people want always is going to lead to adulterated substances, criminal profits, sales to kids, and gang warfare as everybody's fighting over turf. So we're moving in the right direction, but it's not going to happen overnight.
Well, here in Oregon, aside from beer and wine and distilled spirits and all the rest, which we produce here, we've now got a market starting for the state's marijuana crop in the retail adult use. Voters approved that system back in 2014, limited legal possession, cultivation, and eventually regulated sale of marijuana for adults over 21. So what do you think of the new law as far as models go?
Well, I mean, I think Oregon in general is leading the way for other states, though following Colorado and Washington State. I think it's more complicated than it really needs to be. There's an awful lot of, I don't know, fear and kind of panic about this. You know, for example, the no marijuana grown within 1,000 feet of a school or daycare center. I mean, does anybody really think that carrying a toddler to a daycare center past a garden that's got marijuana in it is going to cause some sort of problem. I mean, this is some sort of fantasy. The stuff is not radioactive. Again, there's emotion built into this that doesn't really seem to have any sensible real-world effect, or simply a backdoor way of trying to make it difficult for people to grow and sell marijuana. Now, alcohol is widely available. You can buy beer and wine at any grocery store in Oregon. In fact, I was at Safeway earlier today and picked up a couple bottles of Zinfandel. There were children in the store. Nobody was selling to them, and they weren't freaking out. So I think if we could calm down a little about all this, there's still an overhang of reefer madness from people my age and a little younger that's influencing some of the decision making.
You know, I'm glad you reminded me of the a lot of times when I'm thinking about the comparison to the to some of the restrictions on the within the marijuana, the new marijuana law for retail sale versus alcohol. You think of the most visible, such as bars, strip clubs, and there's at least some bit of distance, usually 1,000 feet, not always, between that and a school. But you're right. I mean, when you the convenience stores, or the beer is on the shelf in the next, the one door away from the soda. And they look kind of the same. You've got the grocery stores. The beer aisle is usually right next to the chips and snacks. It's not like we're protecting kids from alcohol. If anything, we're practically promoting the stuff, all things considered. It's such a level of hypocrisy. Now, that's marijuana. Well, what do you think we should be doing as far as the marijuana laws?
Well, I think at this point we should see how the current law is working out. And, there's a democracy point that local jurisdictions should be able to opt out if they want to, just as all over the country, counties have been able to be dry for alcohol if that's what they want. I think to some extent we're just going to have to see how it works out. And when people realize that the sky is not falling, they may try for something that was a little less convoluted. And the more states that legalize, it's now 23 states for medical marijuana, and four of us plus District of Columbia now for recreational, the more states that sign on to this, I think our representatives and senators in Congress are finally going to have the political cover to change the federal laws. And Oregon senators are certainly taking the lead on this, both Senator Wyden and Senator Merkley, a bill that they recently introduced to make it possible for legal marijuana businesses to use the federal banking system. I mean, this is silly that they're cash-only businesses at the moment, and they're carrying bags of cash to pay their utility bills because they can't use the banks. This is silly and unfortunate, and it needs to change at the federal level. I think we're moving in that direction, but not as fast as one might hope. And I would certainly like to see some more leadership from the president on this.
Folks, once again, we're speaking with Inga Frickland. She's an attorney and former prosecutor who serves on the board of directors of LEAP, that's Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. I'm Doug McVeigh, and you are listening to KBOO Radio in Portland. As you said, things aren't going to change overnight. Well, they do change overnight. It's just that we're not going to necessarily see everything that needs to be done automatically. In the interim, on our way towards all that, toward legal regulation, what other kind of policy changes do you think we should be looking at? Some specifics. How do you feel about some of the harm reduction programs out there, the syringe exchange, the Again, up in Canada, they have these, they have the supervised consumption facilities or safe injection sites. What do you think about that? And should we be a little more tolerant toward those sorts of approaches here?
In general, I think that the use of hard drugs, harm reduction is a very important step. I personally cannot think of any good reason for using heroin. I mean, it's not the way marijuana is more analogous to craft breweries. But we should be trying to, you know, ameliorate the problems that go along with it. So safe injection sites, which is more what Switzerland is doing, I think is very important. Needle exchanges. By prohibiting needle exchanges, we... you know, we're almost condemning to death some of the people who, for whatever stupid reason, got themselves involved in heroin. The wider availability of naloxone, or Narcan is, I guess, one of the brand labels for it, which is an antagonist to heroin. A lot of law enforcement in various parts of the country carry this and can give it to somebody who's in the midst of overdosing on heroin. Other places, for example, Bend, where I live, the chief of police doesn't like this. And so our local police are not carrying it. I think that should be much more widely available. Certainly all these things are kind of way stations on the way to decriminalizing heroin use. Another thing from my own experience that really influenced me from many years ago, my kids went to Chicago public schools, which was a little rough sometimes. But I remember my son, back when he was a junior in high school, he's now 34, one of his classmates died of heroin overdose. I found out about it when I and the other parents were invited to the memorial service. Now, the kids knew that their classmate had gotten involved with drugs, but nobody talked to the adults. I think high school students really don't appreciate either what drug use does or how final death is or what it does to his surviving parents. But they did know you don't rat on a friend to the Chicago police. So they didn't say anything. And I think this 16-year-old died not so much of heroin as of the war on drugs. If this hadn't been illegal, there could have been some intervention to help him. And he would now be a 34-year-old, long since past whatever his problem at 16 was. But he's dead because of our war on drugs. So the more that we can do with harm reduction. Remember, this also has come up just recently for some town, I think it's Austin, Indiana, where the governor has been opposed to needle exchange, and all of a sudden they've realized that they've got a big problem with HIV transmission because of people sharing needles. So because of this emotional reaction that, oh, we can't have needle exchanges, great, we're going to have people die of AIDS or a big public health bill trying to deal with the consequences of it for years to come for these people. So harm reduction, I'm all in favor of it. But I'm also hoping longer term, instead of putting all of our money toward law enforcement, if we put more money into finding out, you know, what are some of the issues that are leading people to get involved with heroin? You know, what is it about the schools that could be made better? Or why is pain such an issue in medical treatment that people are being prescribed opiates, and then when they can't get that, they lead to heroin? Let's try to find out what some of the underlying problems are and address those instead of just declaring usage illegal.
Now, you mentioned decriminalization as an interim step toward legal regulation. Decriminalizing actual possession and use of drugs. Could you speak to a moment? You were a prosecutor. You saw firsthand. How effective or ineffective is the is it to criminalize simple possession and use, busting people, basically just users?
Well, I think busting people who are users is a terrible idea. And at least decriminalization, you know, we quit harassing and locking up those people. But so decriminalization was essentially what the policy was during prohibition of alcohol. It wasn't illegal to possess alcohol and drink it at home. What was illegal was the buying and selling and the trade in it. And as long as that is illegal, there is going to be violence, corruption, adulterated products. You won't know the purity or potency or the pesticide contamination. So decriminalization helps a little bit and will cut down on incarceration and harassment of individual users. But to really get rid of the crime and corruption and to get a grip on, you know, labeling and testing of the various substances, it takes legalization. Decriminalization is not enough.
Let's talk about one more of those interim steps, drug courts. Now, you were a prosecutor in the 80s before we really started the drug court movement. I mean, the first one was, I think it was 89, Florida. The state attorney was Janet Reno. And then after a couple of years, the drug courts just exploded. And frankly, the number of arrests rose pretty much in lockstep with the number of drug courts, the net widening effect. On the one hand, drug courts get some people into treatment. On the other hand, they've also made it easier to put more and more people into the system. But having said that, have you had much experience with the drug courts, and what do you think about the phenomenon?
Well, first of all, even within law enforcement against prohibition, there's some divergence of opinion on this. Some people think, you know, it's a fairly good idea because at least diverts people from getting convictions. I personally do not like the idea of drug courts for several reasons. One is this intermixture of public health and the criminal law. This is diverting somebody into saying they need treatment, which is a medical issue, which is coerced by the criminal law. And I think there's some ethical questions about coerced medical treatment. Second, there's an assumption that treatment is what's required. Now, the statistics are that marijuana is, now the dependence rate is about 9%, which is right up there with caffeine. So it's hard to say that anybody who is found using marijuana is in need of some sort of treatment. That's a political judgment, not a medical one. And you know, if somebody is arrested for drinking in the public park, they don't get sentenced to alcohol court and tested for alcohol use for the next 6 months or a year. Now, most people who use alcohol are not alcoholics and in not need of any sort of treatment. So I don't like this, you know, coercion of something which is a medical treatment based on a medical model that doesn't really seem to be accurate. I think, as you pointed out, it also makes it easier to scoop people up because, hey, we're not giving them a conviction. Well, it's a major intervention with their civil liberties if they're being sent off to a drug court and tested for drugs for could be a year, 6 months. There's a report that came out last September from this Global Commission on Drug Policy, which includes presidents of several countries, and Kofi Annan and George Shultz from the United States, a lot of big names, and they have come out against drug courts for just those reasons, the coercion, the inaccurate medical model. Let's just quit treating these things as crime. Just stop. And to the extent that people are actually addicted, which is mostly the harder drugs. Let's put our resources into non-criminal ways of providing services in a community to people who need and want them.
Indeed. There are some who will argue that, well, we have to get people into treatment. Maybe people won't go in on their own. And the other side of that is that, of course, criminalizing a behavior stigmatize. I mean, we talk about stigma as a barrier. What bigger stigma can there be than calling people, calling people criminals for that behavior? Who's going to raise their hand up to say, yep, I'm a criminal? It's, I could go on that for a little while, but let's shift over for a moment and talk about a couple of other issues. You've got racially biased criminal justice system. That's a huge concern these days. The problem's been around for decades. It's not going to go away just because we legalize drugs. I've been doing this for a long time, and that's just the way it is. We'll eliminate a lot of other problems, and there are a lot of benefits for public safety as well as public health that we see from legalization. But a lot of those basic systemic problems are going to be a little tougher to get rid of. Share with me, if you could, any thoughts you've got on what we should be doing to address some of those systemic problems.
Well, the drugs are a huge part of it. And the fact that the drug laws are on the books and there is a long history of racial bias in how these laws are being carried out, I think it would make a huge difference for police-community relations if we just stopped having drug offenses as offenses. That would remove a lot of the possibilities for some of these really unfortunate police-community interactions. As an interim thing or first step, we need to get rid of the civil asset forfeiture. That goes back to the drug laws. Now, somebody gets stopped, he's got cash on him, that cash can be seized just on the assertion that, hey, maybe it has something to do with drugs. That's irrational, among other things. But it's funding a lot of police departments. The militarization of police departments. We don't have officer friendly anymore. Instead, we've got people with tasers and armored vehicles out of Iraq, night vision goggles. This militarization goes back to the war on drugs. That was the reason behind the first authorizing statutes on that in 1997. So the drugs seem to have tentacles into so many parts of the criminal justice system, the asset forfeiture, the militarization, the police community relations. An awful lot of that can be changed if we would stop the war on drugs and put more of our criminal justice resources into going after the crimes like rape, murder, and arson that really bother people. I remember back when I was a prosecutor in the 80s, the clearance rate on murders was about 90%. Now it's around 60%. And some of that is a change in what sort of crimes are being committed, but some of that is just that police attention has been diverted to fighting the war on crime. The war on drugs. And I think there would also be a lot better cooperation, especially from minority communities, to solve murder cases if the relations with the police were better. And part of the problems of race relations in this country are the number of black citizens who've got criminal records. I mean, even Justice Department figures are that something like 1 out of 3 black males, American citizens, are going to be locked up at some point in their life. Awful lot of that goes back to drugs. So the drug war has helped to create an underclass in minority communities. Now, we're seeing that in places like Baltimore and Chicago, where there's hopelessness. People are not ever going to get a good job. So much of our problems goes back to drugs. And if we could just You know, and stopping the war on drugs is almost like turning a key, provides leverage to improve a whole bunch of things. When we're talking about, oh, initiatives like sensitivity training for police, that's kind of a retail solution. And it's one that requires constant care and maintenance and somebody being interested to keep up the initiative. And these things never seem to last very long. But just change the statute and quit having drugs be criminal.
This is KBOO Portland. I have a brief interruption in the program due to some technical difficulties. We'll be right back with the rest of Political Perspectives in just a moment. So keep it locked right here.
Corners, they're actually shaking down the drug dealers, or they're keeping the drugs themselves once they've seized them. And the way to call a halt to all of that is just legalize. And it just takes a whole set of detrimental police community interactions out of the equation. We're just not going to do this anymore. The sooner this happens, the better.
I'm glad you mentioned the problem of the civil forfeitures and also the corner cutting. Just they're what people might think of as minor ethical things. I mean, you know, full blown corruption is not very typical. It's not very common, but simple ethical things, you know, a little bit of test to lying occasionally. These are things that. It's a slippery slope, I suppose, but, you think about survival skills, and after a time, do you presume that the officer is going to be, as you said, officer-friendly, or do you presume that anytime you're talking to an officer, he could be one of the problems?
Yeah, I think there is an ethical slippery slope. Judges sign off on drug warrants where police are simply asserting, well, based on an informant, there's drugs at this house, so we go break down the door. This may or may not be accurate information. And I remember even going back to the 80s when you look at the arrest reports, defendant dropped a baggie of drugs to the ground when officer approached. Well, you see this in case after case. That seems pretty unlikely. It's as though the entire criminal justice system is kind of complicit in cutting corners here. And it's promoting disrespect for the police and for the law in general. It's a problem. We need to stop.
Oh, it's true. And I know it won't just go away, but you're right. There are a lot of the problems created by drug enforcement that that create these other that have these ripple effects. I say the lack of trust in the community. If you think that the person wearing the badge is just going to come by and shake you down, haven't been doing anything, but what do I have to do to not have you ruin my day? And that's not a healthy. That's not a healthy kind of relationship. I'm speaking with Inga Frickland. She is a former prosecutor. She is resident of Oregon. She's on the board of directors of LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. We're coming up close to the end of the hour. Do you have some final thoughts for the listeners?
Yeah, one thought is that even though we've got a lot of people pointing out what's wrong with the war on drugs, there are some pretty strong constituencies for keeping it going. All the people who work for the DEA, Drug Enforcement Administration, right now, I think their jobs would go away. There's the whole private prison industry that has an interest in keeping a lot of people locked up. People around the world, including the UN Office of Drugs and Crime, that's another constituency that, you know, has jobs and is getting financial support because of the war on drugs. So there are a lot of people who have a stake in it. There are all the police departments who are getting forfeiture money, getting the neat equipment like the Humvees. I was licensed to drive a Humvee when I worked in Afghanistan, and it's cool fun to drive. Police like this sort of thing. So keep in mind that there are some constituencies that are going to be speaking against it, against changing the war on drugs. And they usually trot out the, oh, but it's all about the children. I would be suspicious anytime anyone said it's all about the kids, because that had nothing to do with drugs being made illegal. Instead, let's think logically about legalize in order to regulate and control and stop the war on drugs.
Where do you think we will be in another 10 years? I'm hoping that we've got some momentum and we can keep things going, but where do you think we're headed?
Oh, I think probably within 10 years we will look back and say, what in the world were we thinking having drugs illegal? Legality would also mean there's going to be research on marijuana and the medical properties of it. You know, we hear these anecdotal reports about what marijuana does for kids with epilepsy. If this were some plant discovered in the Amazon by a pharmaceutical company, their stock would be going through the roof. But the fact that it's marijuana, we get all excited about. Again, emotion is overruling, well, health benefits and honest scientific research. So 10 years from now, I really think it's going to be a different world. There are just so many threads coming together right now. The medical benefits of marijuana, the Switzerland and Portugal experience, the concerns about asset forfeiture, the violence in cities like Baltimore and Ferguson. I think we're finally getting a perfect storm of things moving in the right direction. It's coming. We can't be totally irrational for too much longer.
We can but hope. Now, how do people find out more about LEAP?
Check out our website, and I'll also write it to you. It's www.leap.cc. Not .com, it's .cc.
Folks, once again, I have been speaking today with Inga Frickland, an attorney, former prosecutor, board of directors of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. She's a speaker, she's an Oregonian, and Inga, it has been a real pleasure talking with you today.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking with you, and thank you for asking me. We're always delighted for the opportunity to talk about this issue and how complicated it is and what direction it's going.
And this has been Doug McVeigh with KABU News.
Tune in to the podcast Probable Cause This on the KABU website, kboo.fm/probablecause. On this podcast, I look at the top stories on the lack of accountability for police and public officials in Oregon and across the country. That's kboo.fm/probablecause for a weekly roundup of stories on holding our public officials accountable to we the people.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor, along with North Portland Community Building Group, Proper, of the We Can Do It Together community concert. Local politicians, community activists, faith groups, and artists will join in a day of unity, song, and prayer in Kenton Park on Saturday, August 8th, from 4 p.m. to 9 p.m. This concert will feature a variety of local artists that will rally for unity in this time of unrest. Again, that's the We Can Do It Together community concert, Saturday, August 8th from 4 p.m. to 9 p.m. at Kenton Park at North Kilpatrick and Delaware in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And this is KBOO Portland. Time is 9:59 a.m. coming up at 10. Air Cascadia is off today, and we'll hear a full hour of Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11, Sarika Mehta hosts Intersection Radio, aiming to connect communities through unique and unexpected stories. We'll move on at 11:30 to the Radio Zine with Chilean reggae band Aflora Reggae. That's all coming up. For now, let's groove a little. And we'll be moving right along to Flashpoints. So stay tuned right here at your community radio, KBOO. It's 10 a.m.
Today on Flashpoints, we begin with coverage of the upcoming legislative elections in Haiti that are scheduled for this Sunday, August 9th.